It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For 70 years, a Chicago public housing community known as Cabrini Green stood in Chicago. In 2011, the last of the demolition that began in 1995 was finished. Cabrini Green was home to thousands, in fact, 15,000 at its peak, at home in over 3,500 living units. It once towered over Chicago's most valuable neighborhoods, and it came to be a looming reminder of inequality and poverty. Cabrini's high-rises were demolished, and an African-American community cleared to make room for another social experiment, mixed-income neighborhoods. 70 Acres in Chicago is a new documentary film that tells the volatile story of this hotly contested patch of land in Chicago. It also looks at race, class, and who has the right to live in the city. It's a film to be screened that will be followed by a panel discussion this Friday, March 25th at 6 p.m. in the main library of the University of Iowa. Here's a short excerpt from the film in which former resident Mark Pratt is visiting the demolition site as Cabrini Green was coming down.
This is where I grew up at. My first time coming over here when they first started the demolition, the guys broke work for the day right in my mother's living room. She kept her living room like immaculate. We couldn't even go in and sit in it. So just think that there was a bulldozer in the living room. It's like, man, mom will kill them. It's hard. I didn't think I would take it this hard, but it's hard. It's hard watching, you know, what once was your home just being destroyed. I just pray and hope that they replace it with something better for the people here, not just the people who are buying property here.
That was Mark Pratt, a former resident of Cabrini Green in Chicago, featured in the film 70 Acres in Chicago, a new documentary film. Joining us this hour, the director of 70 Acres in Chicago, Cabrini Green. Name is Ronit Bezalel. Hello, Ronit.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for joining us. Also, Janet Smith is with us, Associate Professor of Urban Planning and co-director of the Nathalie P. Voorhees Center for Neighborhood and Community Improvement at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Janet, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hope to be joined by the person's voice, person whose voice we just heard a moment ago, Mark Pratt, in a few minutes as well. But let's start off with telling us a little bit about Cabrini Green. Many of our listeners may have heard that name, but will not know its history and certainly all the things that you've wrapped into this documentary films. Tell us a little bit about the history of Cabrini Green and why you sought it out as the focus of this documentary.
So when I first arrived in Chicago, it was 1994, and I came to the city from Canada, and I actually knew nothing about Cabrini Green, but I soon learned that it was very infamous in the city in the sense that it was heralded, and I'm going to have air quotes here, as the failure of public housing or the worst public housing development in the country. And those are air quotes that I use loosely, but that was its sort of claim to fame at that point. There were a lot of news clippings and sound bites of how, quote, notorious the place was. Cabrini Green was on 70 acres of land. There were 15-story, 16-story high-rises and then two flats. At its peak, 16,000 people lived in the development. It started in the 40s, and 50s and 60s was built, and then, as you alluded to, was demolished in 2011.
Mm-hmm. And tell us where it's located. We visit Chicago if we don't live there here in Iowa, and we know that this is just west of sort of the coast that's, I guess the Navy Pier is part of.
Yeah, Cabrini Green is located, I would say, about 5 miles north of downtown, a few miles from the lake, a few miles west from the lake. Mm-hmm. It's right next to the neighborhood called the Gold Coast. And Cabrini Green and the Gold Coast are stark contrast. And that's one thing that we look at in the film. The Gold Coast is seen as some of Chicago's most valuable property and most expensive real estate. And Cabrini Green at the time, the property values at the time were not very high, but then became high, which is the reason why it was demolished.
Mm-hmm. Janet Smith, pick up the story there. The demolition of Cabrini Green began in 1995. As I mentioned, the last bit of it went to March, I believe, of 2011. Tell us that story, the reason for demolishing. How did that process take place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Cabrini-Green's demolition is really part of a larger effort across the United States, beginning during the first Bush administration, to look at what was called the worst-case housing in the United States. That's public housing. And the U.S. at that time had gained a reputation as being a slumlord in its public housing. And it was focusing, though, on a very small portion of public housing, less than 7% at the time of the public housing stock, which was about 1.4 million units across the country. So public housing isn't that much, first of all, in the context of housing. In Chicago, it's about 2% of our housing at the time in the 90s. So the idea of the demolition came about with the sense that it was really impossible to redevelop this housing because the quality of it, due to large-scale disinvestment, the federal government not in putting money into the upkeep, and even actually the original building of the buildings. So first of all, you have a quality problem. There was also, though, a social quality problem, and that was where the sort of tensions, I guess, would come about on this question of a culture of poverty, that this kind of housing was primarily occupied by very low-income people. In Chicago, that would be people earning – families earning less than $10,000 a year, so below – you know, well below poverty. And so there was a combination of the quality of the housing, the very low income being concentrated, but also high vacancy rates. And you can imagine why people didn't want to live there if the quality of the housing is not so good and they had other options. So Cabrini actually was not slated for full demolition. It received a small grant for which then later on it's called the HOPE 6 program, HOPE standing for Housing Opportunities for People Everywhere. HOPE 6 was a program that was created, like I said, during the Bush administration and continued through the Clinton administration and just recently sunsetted. But it was used for demolition and redevelopment of public housing across the country. Cabrini-Green was one of the first grants in the country as well as in Chicago. It was initially for a very small amount of redevelopment. Less than 600 units were going to be demolished instead of the 3,600 that were slated later on. And it really, I think, signifies what happened between the initial idea, which came out of residents working together with the Public Housing Authority to look at a portion of the buildings that were in bad shape, to say, let's redevelop these and make these better and focus on mixed-income housing, to within a few years, the City Hall and what many would call the back room, smoke-filled room, whatever, decision to instead tear all the housing down, except for the row houses, actually. They did retain those for a while and are still somewhat – still standing. But the idea of turning the whole area into a large mixed income development with a lot of, you know, with the majority of it being market rate housing. And as Ronit alluded to earlier, this neighborhood was changing. People were building $1 million homes near Cabrini-Green before it was torn down. And research that's been done has shown that around the United States at the time in the mid-90s, a lot of HOPE 6 grants coincidentally, we're aligning with gentrifying neighborhoods. And so there's one of the questions that comes up is, you know, from residents' perspective, saw this as a land grab.
Mm-hmm. Ronit, talk about that. The opposition, when did it surface from the community members of Cabrini-Green, and how strong was it?
I think the opposition has always been there. Even before Cabrini-Green was going to be torn down, there were members of the community. We have a scene in our film, and it goes back to the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it was like, don't tear down our community. You know, fix it up. Don't displace us. We need something done now. So from the very, very beginning, there have been opposition. And one of the key elements is, were the residents' voices listened to? And that became a key thing throughout the whole redevelopment of Cabrini-Green.
And after this documentary, all the research you put into it, what answer did you get to that question? Were they considered? Were they heard?
I don't think residents' voices were heard, and any gains that the residents got was because they went to court and fought for their rights. The Cabrini-Green Local Advisory Council, and there was the Coalition to Protect Public Housing, Carol Steele, and other residents' leaders took the CHA to court and made their gains that way.
Mm-hmm. Can I add one other thing?
Absolutely.
I think Janet. One of the things that I would add where their voices were heard were outside of Chicago and outside of even the United States. The residents through the Coalition to Protect Public Housing invited, back in I think it was 2004, invited the Special Rapporteur on Housing from the United Nations to come to Chicago and look at the quote-unquote atrocities of public housing redevelopment. There were not, you know, as large of the displacements that we were seeing in, say, Zimbabwe and other places, but to make the parallels with the kind of displacement and removal of people of color from communities. And I think that made a really strong statement, and it continued on. The Special Rapporteur of Housing, Raquel Ronick came to Chicago in 2009, again, to see what was going on. The residents themselves were invited to testify in New York and to testify around these atrocities. And so I think what's important there is to note that they felt that even though their voices were not necessarily being heard at the local level, they could not help themselves but to continue. And if they were going to help themselves, but not just themselves, but others like them. So looking at the sort of across the country, what was happening in other cities, it was important to get these voices heard.
Janet Smith is with us, associate professor at the University of Chicago at Illinois, an expert in urban planning, also the director of a new documentary film, 70 Acres in Chicago, telling the story of Cabrini Green. Ronit Bezalel is with us, the director of that film. We're talking about the themes here, and a little later in the hour, we'll talk about some urban development going on here in Iowa, see how that fits in thematically as well. If you'd like to join us, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. I wanted to play another excerpt from this film. Perhaps you can help me set it up, Ronit. This is where you interview students at Jenner Elementary School. We'll hear a few voices there in just a moment, but please give us the context. Jenner Elementary is adjacent to Cabrini Green?
Yes, Jenner Elementary is one of the elementary schools at Cabrini Green. I believe there were three when Cabrini was around. And we went into film that day and Mayor Daley was speaking. He was at that time the mayor of Chicago. And to set it up, he had a press conference, but he wasn't mentioning anything about the public housing that was going on or the demolition. And not, you know, 100 feet away, the houses were coming down. And so Jenner is sort of the epicenter of all of the redevelopment because you have all these kids coming in, going to school here, and seeing their homes torn down. And it was very emotional. It was a very emotional time during when we were there filming.
Here's a short audio excerpt from the film at Jenner Elementary talking to students as described by Ronit.
It was like the buildings had so many people, and then to see it come down, it's like everybody getting moved away. So it's like we getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's sad to see like everybody go in our neighborhood. Like it's like it's come to an end.
I don't see how anybody could be optimistic about it. They might place some new buildings here, but it ain't gonna be the same people.
I hope that they rebuild it, but let the residents who they moved out come back in, so we can be a community again.
Community, the last word, part of the word there, too. So let's talk about that, because also in this part of the film, Ronit, there are several students who confront then-Mayor Richard Daley. And if I'm quoting him more or less correctly, they're saying, how would you like it if someone came and tore your community down?
Definitely. Yeah, that's what the next clip is that we're going to be hearing. And the one you just heard was an eighth grade classroom at Cabrini Green. And the teacher was Miss Tara Stamps, who's also featured in the film.
So talk about this a little bit. You focused on, even though we have over the years, Cabrini Green connected with crime, gang violence, neglect, people living in really deplorable conditions. It became synonymous with the problems associated with public housing in the United States. Yet that is not the focus of this documentary. Ronit, what is the focus? You have a much more positive focus. You focus on community here.
You know, the film is multifaceted, and one part of it does definitely focus on community. It's a story that really wasn't told. In Chicago, there's a lot of sound bites about the negativity of Cabrini Green. But people who didn't live there did not know that it was also a very strong, vibrant place where people really wanted to go. We have a scene in the film, And it looks at a weekly celebration called Old School Monday, which is just so full of love and laughter and music and dancing. And I think that really embodies the spirit of Cabrini Green. Everyone I talked to who lived there mentioned that and talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely decided to focus on the community aspect. And also, what is community? What makes a community? How do we define community? What is home? What does it mean to have our home taken away from us? And sometimes people ask, is this a Chicago story? And I say, no. I mean, your listeners in Iowa can relate to this. You know, we're having these discussions all over the country and the world.
Right. Janet Smith, jump in there, because I know you study
yeah.
a lot of community. We have communities
yeah.
here in Iowa, in Chicago.
Yeah.
What is different about this community, and what is the same as any community
yeah.
in Iowa, for instance?
Right. I think it's really interesting. The history of studying community, if you go back to urbanization, there was sort of this longing and desire for the community that used to be in, you know, that people thought of as rural, more where it's small town, people knew each other. So you go to the city and everyone, you know, we don't know each other. It's depersonalized. And I think that image carries over in public housing. And I would argue that actually that's the opposite. I live in a high-rise building. I know a few people in my building, but I'm not real social, and I wouldn't say, oh, I have someone I could call and be my babysitter. Whereas if you go into public housing, 9 times out of 10, everybody knows at least, 10 people nearby, and they can call on them to take care of children, to, help them out with groceries or something like that. It's a very, what we would call an extended family, large community. And you'd hear, people talking about their auntie, and their auntie, it's not their related, by blood auntie, but it's somebody who's taking care of them when they were growing up as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what is beautiful about this film, and sad at the same time, is that it reveals a part of the lives and the community that's there that's very strong. And what's sad about it is to sort of see the disregard for that community and to say, well, we can just demolish. And more importantly, your concentration as poor people is disregarded, and that there we don't see the resilience and actually the ability for community to survive, for people to survive because of the community they created. And instead we say, oh, no, you must go off and we're going to disperse you out into the community
right.
and you have to fend for yourself.
Well, Janet, was it when you see this film, is it a community that was not recognized as a community, or as a community that was inferior? And so you can just break it apart, disperse it.
Well, I think you can say both. Not recognized as a community because the framework, which would be primarily a middle class, idea or ideal of community. And so in terms of behaviors and things that they, when you don't have as much money as a middle income family, you behave differently. You have to find ways to survive. And so in terms of taking care of each other and not, you don't have the resources to buy certain services and things like that. But I would also say, sort of it's a disregard of this community seen as inferior because of that definition, right? And so I think what Ronit's film does, and this and larger discussion that people are having about public housing and communities or lower income communities in general, is to say we have to really understand community first. Don't put a label on it just because we've identified them by income, or in the case of public housing by their status or their tenure status because they're renters, that they live in public housing. And also let's not forget that race and ethnicity has come into play here as well, because a large portion, especially in Chicago but around the country, a large portion of public housing residents are of color. And so it's raising all these questions about how we actually define community. And I think there's a longing and desire some people have still for that old-fashioned idea of community, but it doesn't really exist in many of our cities and our urban areas. But I think you find it more in public housing, interestingly.
Okay. We're talking with those involved with a film, 70 Acres in Chicago, a new documentary telling the story of this hotly contested patch of land that used to be Cabrini Green, a public housing community known as Cabrini Green. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Jonathan, listening to our program, joining us from Des Moines. You have a connection with Cabrini Green, Jonathan?
Yeah. I actually lived on the corner of Chicago Avenue, which is right on the north side of Cabrini Green.
When did you live there?
That would have been back in the mid-'80s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I lived in that neighborhood against all odds, so to speak, as, the air quotes go. And
you're a white man?
Yes, I'm Caucasian, Asian American, and the thing that I saw and the thing that I lived in Chicago for quite a while, off and on. Gentrification is the question, and oftentimes gentrification is simply an economic land grab. It's a way of producing income for a small amount of people without regard for the atmosphere that is in the neighborhoods that they gentrify. Mm-hmm. I moved from Cabrini Green to Bucktown, from Bucktown to Wicker Park, from Wicker Park to Tilson. Tilson was the place where I saw the community come together against the gentrification the most. The areas of Wicker Park that got seriously gentrified were no better off than they were when it wasn't gentrified. There was still gang fights that went through the community. There were still drug problems. There were still homeless problems. The difference was everything cost more.
Okay.
And it was extremely aggravating as a low to middle income person trying to make it. I owned three businesses during that time, and because of gentrification, I could never get the economic muscle to actually make a go of it.
Okay, Jonathan, we're coming up on a break. Some great observations there from Jonathan. Mm-hmm. Ronit, mm-hmm. Talk about that, because gentrification is talked in your film in a negative way, but also in a positive way. You talked with people who moved into these mixed neighborhoods following the demolition of Cabrini Green, didn't you?
Yeah, and Jonathan, I really like your definition of gentrification. That was really wonderful. We talked to people who moved into the mixed income homes, and I think one thing we looked at is which class, which race are privileged in these homes, which culture is really privileged here. And we look at some of the uncertainties and some of the trouble that the Cabrini residents are having because of rules and many tests that they have to go through. But we wanted to give different voices a chance to speak, and the whole point of the film is to have dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Is to have dialogue and have wider themes, because Cabrini Green is not unique in the United States, is it, Ronit?
No, I mean, we've got Cabrini Greens everywhere. Cabrini Green became a symbol. It was in the mainstream media. There's the film Candyman. You know, the TV show Good Times is based on Cabrini Green. But we can take this, and now we can use it to talk about race and class discussions that so many people are uncomfortable having. You know, Cabrini is mostly gone. It's still there. There's still the row houses. There's one street, Cambridge, which is there. But the legacy of Cabrini is, let's start having these difficult discussions. Let's
We're going to keep talking after a short break here on River to River. Ronit Bezalel is with us, director of 70 Acres in Chicago, Cabrini Green. Janet Smith of the University of Illinois. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We'll talk with the voice from the film of one of the former residents of Cabrini Green who managed to still live there. We'll talk about that case when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about the lessons learned from the public housing community known as Cabrini Green, 70 acres in the heart of Chicago. It stood there, was demolished. The demolishing of that finished in 2011, began in 1995, and over 15,000 residents at its peak, over 3,500 units, 99% African American. We're talking with a filmmaker, the director of 70 Acres in Chicago, Cabrini Green, and also Janet Smith of the University of Illinois at Chicago, an expert on urban planning. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You want to talk about what is on the site of Cabrini Green now, and how many of the residents of that former public housing community are still on that site. But let's first go to Lucas, who's been listening in Fairfield. Hi, Lucas.
Howdy.
What's your tie-in here?
Well, I lived in Chicago with my family for about 12 years, beginning in 1990. And just as my dad was a chaplain at the Cook County Prison and Juvenile Detention Center. So we kind of had that background, and, you know, driving by there, we would a couple of times heard gunshots close enough to, hear through the car. As far as the community aspect is concerned, I agree there's a community there, but, from my perspective and my dad's perspective, as his son, I can say that I also saw the, hugely negative effects.
Mm-hmm.
One time a 10-year-old had gotten hold of a revolver from his family's house, and he ended up in the detention center and threatened my dad. This is a 10-year-old coming right from that area. So,
okay, Lucas, thank you for that experience there from your family. Let's talk about that a little bit, Ronit and Janet, because we don't want to gloss over the fact that this was, while being a community, also a horribly violent place, Ronit.
I mean, it definitely was. There was violence at Cabrini, and I think that's something we never deny. But we're also looking at the other parts of Cabrini that have gotten erased with the narrative. There's violence everywhere, which is so unfortunate and so tragic in our country. And it's not just particular to Cabrini Green. But I think what we're saying is, how do you preserve the community? How do you preserve the good parts of the community without doing away with everything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would add that, there's two points I want to emphasize. Is that, as Ronit underscored, that we do know that there was violence there. There's violence everywhere, to the degree it looks, different in different communities. But I think, I remember talking to residents when there was a shooting of a young child, and talking about how, they were uncomfortable with it. And when you look at it, a majority of the people living in these communities, in public housing specifically, are not violent. And what you have to look at is where the violence comes from and how it manifests itself. And we can talk about, unfortunately, kids having guns anywhere in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to discount the caller's concern, but this happens just about everywhere in the United States, unfortunately, now we know, or we're more aware of. I think the other thing is that there's a sort of an image of drugs, right, and drug usage and drug selling. And public housing is complicated in that regard, in that, yes, there are people who sell and use drugs in public housing. And by the way, they do in the suburbs as well. They just don't get drug tested for it. OK, so when you live in mixed income housing now, there's a sort of a different treatment of public housing residents from non-public housing residents. And so, like, the developer who built Cabrini Green prides himself on drug testing. But when you dig a little deeper into it, you find out that the only people who are drug tested are the public housing residents, because the assumption is that they're the only ones using drugs. But at the same time, we know that drug usage in the United States there's no different treatment, if you will, based on the data. And so I think that's one of the things that is unfortunate in the way that the policies have been implemented, is that they treat public housing residents as second class. I wouldn't even say second class, third class citizens at times. So to be able to live in public housing, you have to use the term pee in a cup. Okay.
Right. Let's listen to a little clip from Ronit's film here. She followed Deidre Brewster, one of the original residents of Cabrini Green. We want to hear a little bit about her talking about this aspect of yearly drug tests. But set it up for us, Ronit. Who is Deidre Brewster?
Deidre Brewster is a woman who did live at Cabrini Green and now lives at one of the new mixed income communities. And she talked to us about some of the challenges, some of the things that residents from Cabrini Green had to go through to be able to move back into the community.
Okay. African-American, point that out. 99% of the people who lived in Cabrini Green were African-American. Here is Deidre Brewster, who fought to preserve the community of Cabrini Green and was relocated to the mixed-income housing development, but at a cost.
I believe the process to come back into the new mixed income development communities, you actually have to be a nun. There is no room for mess ups. But I think it's kind of dehumanizing for a public housing residents of Cabrini Green to have to be subject to, I believe it's a yearly drug test. When my 18-year-old daughter's background check came back, she had a misdemeanor. This was from her having a fight in school, but that was something they got on her record. We had to make a tough choice in order to be back in our community. And She's now living with relatives because she could not be a part of my lease and live here in Cabrini, in the mixed income development. God forbid if she ends up homeless, what am I going to do as a mom? Not let her come here? I don't know.
Roni, talk about Deidre there and how representative she is. Is she a small minority who were, went over the hurdles needed? And she described some of them there to stay at the former site of Cabrini Green.
Deidre was one of the few residents who was able to come back. And that story, every time I hear it, it hurts. It's just so sad and also infuriating that she would have had to make that choice. She's someone who just wants to, fight for the community, raise a family, and not cause any trouble.
Right.
And she had to make a horrific choice.
Right. What parent of a teenager, if you have several kids especially, how many of them go through their teen years without some sort of misdemeanor or without some sort of trouble?
Or how many kids, maybe, white kids in the suburbs go in, they're in a fight, but it's not on the record, and they wouldn't have that problem to begin with. So, the thing that happened was so small, and the implications and what happened was so great. The consequences were so great for something so minor.
Okay. Let's go to Kevin in North Liberty. Kevin, we don't have much time. We're going to be moving on, but we wanted to get your opinion, your view on this discussion of the public housing community known as Cabrini Green and the lessons it has for us.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I lived in that area. I lived in Chicago for a while, and Cabrini Green was a drug rat, crime-infested area. They're making it sound like a Shangri-La. And the gentleman who just called you from Fairfield, I used to be in the utility business. Linemen from Commonwealth Edison in Chicago, if they had to go into Cabrini Green, you know who scared them when they were going in there with a power outage? It was a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old, because those were the kids who were going to make their names for themselves and be able to get themselves in a gang if they shot somebody.
Mm. Okay, Kevin, thanks for your input. What about this, making it look like, in the words of Kevin, a Shangri-La, Ronit?
I think one thing that's interesting is all the callers from Chicago, Cabrini is a heated place in Chicago, and we will talk about we love to talk about Cabrini forever. It's something that really inspires a lot of talk and conversation. And yes, there were negative things about Cabrini. I don't think we're saying that it was the great utopia, Hilton, luxury hotel, Shangri-La. It was a place with problems. There was poverty. There was drugs. There was violence. But at the same time, what makes this place a paradox is, as we say, there was a very strong community of residents, very strong, good values, people who just wanted to have a safe, clean place to live.
Yeah, I would encourage any caller now who's in Iowa to go see the film. The film speaks for itself, and I think that's what's important here, is that it shows, I think the appropriate term is paradox. And so, yes, there's violence, but there's also just families. And I think we need to all understand that before we jump to one side or the other in terms of what kind of space it was, because it was a lot of both.
Janet Smith is with us of the University of Illinois at Chicago, also the director of the documentary film we're focusing on this hour, 70 Acres in Chicago, Cabrini Green. Ronit Bezalel is with us via ESDN in Chicago. We want to add one more participant in our conversation. Ann Greenwald is with us, president and CEO of Four Oaks. That's a not-for-profit social services agency in Cedar Rapids, an agency that deals with at-risk children, joining us by phone. Hello, Ann.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I don't know how much of our conversation you've heard, but we wanted to tie you in here as we're talking about community this hour, community as it relates to housing. Tell us about the approach that you take at Four Oaks in dealing with families, children who are at risk in Cedar Rapids, where you're working in the Wellington Heights area.
Sure, be glad to. Wellington Heights is a historic, long-term core neighborhood in our community. And because we have been trying to serve those children who are at risk, many who have lived in Wellington Heights, we became increasingly concerned about the deteriorating nature of that neighborhood. And so after the flood of 2008, once those neighborhoods that were impacted by the flood had been restored, We inquired with donors who had invested in bringing back neighborhoods that had been flooded about whether those dollars could be repurposed to some other core neighborhoods where we could work on making the same kind of improvements to the non-flood-impacted neighborhoods that were really being severely stressed as well. And those donors did agree. So in 2012, we identified about an 18-block area in the Wellington Heights neighborhood, which is a neighborhood comprised of about 600 homes, and there's a higher proportion of African-American families that live in that neighborhood. And it also is a neighborhood where working poor and other distressed families have also lived over time, and landlords during that time had really not been keeping up all the property. So there were increased police calls, et cetera. So all of the indicators that the neighborhood was going in the wrong direction. So with the help of the city and Linn County and a number of organizations in town, we set about a plan to acquire 100 properties in that 18-block neighborhood over a five-year period, for the purpose of restoring them, oftentimes reducing the density of a unit, say taking a fourplex down to a twoplex. The idea being that once some of these properties, we could get to a tipping point where once some of these properties were in better physical condition, had the appropriate landlords maintaining the quality of that, of those properties, and providing support to the tenants along with the neighborhood association, it would get us into a position where we would start to see not only the reduction of density, but also the reduction of crime and increase in home ownership.
Mm-hmm. Are you feeling that you're meeting this goal? You're still in the midst of it. How do you know?
We're in the midst of it. We're in the midst of it, and we've acquired 91 out of the 100 target properties and have restored approximately 70% of those. The rest are in process right now. The density in that neighborhood has been reduced by about 30%. Five new homes have been built in that neighborhood for the first time in 50 years, and all five homes have been sold. So we're getting all of the right indicators that indicate that the objectives we were trying to achieve when we set forth with this plan are working. We also have tenants or residents who are part of the neighborhood association who are really emboldened by all of the efforts that are happening, not only with the 100 houses that I mentioned, but also other homeowners in that same neighborhood have taken it upon themselves, with support from Habitat for Humanity and also from other city programs, to do their own property restoration. So in summary, what I'm saying is that there's a real pride coming back to that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And in pursuit of this goal, what have been the biggest challenges, perhaps ones you didn't anticipate?
Some of the challenges have been needing to work hand-in-hand with the city and realtors, et cetera, around strengthening the landlord nuisance abatement ordinance. There had been an opportunity for landlords who didn't necessarily want to keep up their property, rented to people who were heavily involved in crime. So we had to tackle that challenge head-on and are very fortunate that the city of Cedar Rapids took the leadership in making those improvements in the last couple of years. So that was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the additional challenges we've run into are all these kinds of programs, particularly for affordable housing, are dependent on local and federal funding to underwrite some of the costs involved. And, you know, as with everything else, some of those purse strings have been tightening, so we've had to become more creative, and the costs have just risen as we've proceeded. So those are a couple of them that come to mind that have been challenges we've had to tackle along the way.
Ann Greenwald is with us, Four Oaks, a not-for-profit social services agency in Cedar Rapids, talking about renewal of the Wellington Heights area in Cedar Rapids. Janet Smith is an expert in urban planning. What are you hearing in the Wellington Heights story that is common to Wellington Heights, perhaps Cabrini Green, and other places where urban renewal is going on?
Well, first of all, very interesting in terms of the strategy. it's parallel in a way to what is being, done around public housing redevelopment in the sense of reducing density, especially in the initial public housing redevelopment, which was dealing with high-rise buildings primarily and reducing the density under the assumption that you don't want to have that many, especially large families. Those can be debated sometimes as to whether density is the problem, I would argue, sometimes versus the upkeep of buildings, which is what I really heard concerns about, was the quality of the properties, the commitment of landlords to upkeep and sort of changing that mindset. And what you hear, and research has shown here in Chicago as well, is that when you change the attitude of those who have the power to control what happens to properties, that is the property owners, and in the case of Chicago Public Housing, it's the Public Housing Authority, when you change that so that they actually invest in the properties and they do the upkeep that's needed, often here in Chicago, residents would talk about putting in requests for upkeep and maintenance that was needed, and waiting and not having anything happen. And you hear these stories around the country, by the way, because there was never sufficient resources for that to happen. But what you see is, more importantly, is the results of that and the attitudes and the sort of the feeling of hope that can come with residents. And I think that that's something that, we would hope with all of our public housing redevelopment and those parallels with what is being described in Iowa. However, I think one of the things that we would see as different here is that the residents have been suspicious of the intentions. And so whereas, as we were discussing earlier, the residents at Cabrini really saw this as not to benefit them, the kind of security, the kind of upkeep, and the kind of improvements were not necessarily to benefit the residents and their ability to return. And so at Cabrini anyway, the large number of people who were removed from that public housing, very few technically could come back just because of the number of units available, but also whether or not they could pass the screening and all the different things. And so I think redevelopment, when it's done with intention and driven by and with community, the residents there, sure, we want to screen out some bad apples. That's understandable everywhere. And that includes the landlords as well as tenants. But I think this idea of working with and knowing that this is being done for the people who are there, that is a really important and a very positive message to hear.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of minutes left. I want to go back to Ann Greenwald. Want to get your reaction to the latest spike in gun violence among teens in Cedar Rapids, three recent shootings, I believe two just over the weekend. What do you see as behind that? It must be a great concern of yours.
Of course, and it is really tragic that we're seeing that spike. And in fact, what's even more interesting is the police department has been tracking crime stats in all the core neighborhoods for the past 7 years, and shots fired is really the outlier. All the other indicators of crime are moving down, and so what it really says is that youth and adults are really not finding constructive ways to deal with some disputes. And as you'll hear in the media, even internationally, sometimes social media is really, kind of creating a frenzy of behaviors and when guns are available, it really becomes too easy to have that gun violence be the way to escalate the conflicts that are going on. Another thing I would say is that one of the easy fixes would be to secure the guns. The police department is reporting that many of these weapons are being obtained by stealing them from cars, and the cars aren't locked.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the efforts have to be simply on making sure that the availability of guns is better managed, and then the other is to really help those involved learn to deal with their emotions in a much more constructive and safe manner.
Ronit Bezalel, I just have 30 seconds for you. Give us some hope. Looking forward after doing this documentary film, the larger questions of community, diversity, integration, what gives you hope after completing this documentary film?
What gives me hope is that when we screen the film, it's been sold out every single time it's played. People want to talk. They want to dialogue about the issues in the film. There's a lot of concerned citizens, and that's what I draw strength and hope from.
Okay. We want to mention again the screening of this film, 70 Acres in Chicago, Cabrini Green, this Friday at 6 p.m. at the main library at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. We want to thank you very much, Ronit Bezalel, director of 70 Acres in Chicago, for coming into the studio. And
thank you.
Thank you, Janet Smith of the University of Illinois. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And Ann Greenwald, of course, president and CEO of Four Oaks in Cedar Rapids. Thank you for joining our discussion.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Politics Day, international politics, we'll focus on tomorrow on the program. Hope you'll join us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until then.